Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregenauer with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
And this is Peter Bregen. Hello out there, my marvelous listening audience, an audience that itself is the cutting edge, I'm sure, of reform in mental health in the world. Glad to be talking to you again. Today, I've got a guest on that you really are going to want to hear the whole hour's worth. So remember that this is got a little podcast kind of stuff that you can just delve right into anytime you want in the archives of PRNFM. We're really going to go deep today, but before going there, a few things to tell you about. First of all, if you haven't seen American Addict, you need to get it and view it. You can Google it on American Addict Film. Just Google American Addict Film and you'll get there. There's a lot of good people who play a role in the film, and I get some of the best things to say because they were actually interested in some of my more expansive or overarching commentaries. But it's an incisive examination of the drug company influence over our lives and what needs to be done about it. American Addict. It's a well-received, really excellent documentary. Now, I want to remind you all that we are doing co-conferencing in the next few years with some really good people. And April 17, 18, and 19 probably, which is the Sunday, but April 17, 18, probably half a day on 19, we are joining Bert Caron, one of the great psychologists of our time. He's been psychologist of the year. He wrote The Psychotherapy of Schizophrenia. Bert and I together, that is our Empathic Therapy Center, which is me and Ginger, and our great advisory council of some 70-odd folks, we are going to co-conference with Bert at Michigan State University. We're going to fly over country. Michigan State University in East Lansing on their campus in a great facility. You're going to get to hear a lot from our individual presenters. We're not doing breakout sessions like so many conferences. We're just going to have a few good presenters. Bert, of course, myself, Bert and I will do one of our famous conversations about life and therapy. Bob Whitaker's promised to come if he's in the country. Mary Olson from Open Dialogue, which developed in Sweden and treats patients who would ordinarily be labeled schizophrenic in such a good way, mostly with family intervention and very little drugs, that they virtually have eliminated so-called schizophrenia in Lapland, Finland. Kevin Miller, my dear friend, Letters from Generation RX's newest film, will be there to show his new film. So it's going to be really good. So set aside, we haven't got it up on the web yet, I don't think, but set aside April 17th and 18th, maybe the 19th, 2015. Did I say 14? I don't remember. 2015. Next year in Michigan. See you there. My guest, Michael, are you there?
Yes, Peter.
Hello. My guest is Hello. Michael Cornwall. Michael's a Jungian, Langian. He describes himself as a psychotherapist. And in his own words, he went through an intense experience of transformative madness without medication or treatment. And that's informed his life, his vocation, his profession. He's been doing stuff about as long as I have, and And he's worked for just decades with people who are in psychotic states and medication-free sanctuaries and community settings. He got a PhD. He may tell us a little bit about this at the Diabasis House. Is that how it's pronounced, Michael?
Yes, Diabasis House. I did the follow-up doctoral research on that medication-free psychosis sanctuary.
Well, that is that. That, you know, we're going to just hear a lot of interesting stuff. His mentor there was John W. Ware, and right now he's very active at Esalen Institute. He's a workshop leader there. He holds all kinds of interesting, cutting-edge, frontier kinds of seminars. We'll hear some about that. He blogs on Madness in America, as do a number of the folks that you hear on my show. And in my own opinion, he's involved in some of the most advanced thinking and work in the field of helping people with psychotic states. Michael, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Peter. It's great to be here again. Thank you.
Well, where would you like to take off on, Michael? I was thinking maybe we should just leap right in and talk about what is psychosis.
Sounds good. Well, to start that conversation, maybe I should share a little bit about my own experience. We thought that was a good idea. And I must say that more and more we're seeing people sharing about their experiences. And I think that is a huge gift to others who may be going into such an experience. And I think it also helps to create an evidence base of sorts so that refutes the medical model that says when people go through these experiences that they have a brain disease. So shall I just talk a little bit about my own
experience? Yeah, I would love to hear you to talk about what you went through and how you came out.
Well, thinking about it, it's almost 50 years since that happened, but I must say it's been with me every day since. I was a young man, obviously, younger than I am now, but about 18 years old in a rural state, and it was during the height of the Vietnam War. I think it was about 1968. And I had been against the war, and most of my friends were going into the Marines, God bless them, and to serve. But I was in a real quandary around identity, and I think so many young people, when they're moving into young adulthood, go through a tremendous struggle sometimes to find out what's right for them, maybe different than what their parents want. And also, I think it's a time when a lot of issues that have been kind of contained until then come to the surface. That was certainly true for me. I'll just say that I believe that most of the causation for people becoming psychotic or whatever, going into extreme states, comes from early experience. There's so much evidence now about trauma and the role of trauma in the causation of extreme states in young adults and everyone. I think the literature shows now that probably half of women who have been given a schizophrenic diagnosis have been sexually abused. So for my own life, I was the young boy whose parents had left him. I guess the word might be abandoned, when I was a toddler, and I went to live with my great-grandmother and grandmother. So I had early, it wasn't overt trauma, but I had early hurts and losses. And when I was young, I'd burnt my hand severely and had third-degree burns and was in the hospital for quite a while. I think all that kind of set me up when I was at that young adult stage, especially with the ingredient of LSD added to it, to go off the deep end. And it was really terrifying, Peter. It was a journey that took me year and a half to finally emerge from, where I was really out of my mind. I was delusional. I thought the radio, the TV was talking to me. I heard voices, especially one very harsh voice that terrorized me. I had the good fortune to be living with my aged grandmother, who was in her 80s. She was somewhat demented at that point. And so she raised me and my sister, and she was a very loving person. So through this course of my own madness, I had the opportunity to be in a sanctuary of sorts, which, as we talk on, I'm very interested in having those available for people today and have worked in some of them. But anyway, the subjective experience of that being in a waking nightmare, walking around at night, raving, and this police stopped me a couple of times on the street. Thank God they didn't pull me in. Where I lived, if you were in that kind of condition and got before any medical authority, you got shipped to the state hospital. We only had one psychiatric facility in the whole state. So as a boy, I'd heard stories about, she got sent to the state hospital. And, so I knew in my memory that people who went there usually didn't come back. But I must say, Peter, even during that time, there would be moments of or hours of lucidity where I didn't feel like going for the kind of help that was available, the medical psychiatric help. I had this deep sense that what I was going through, I had the sense it would never end. That's the terrifying place for people sometimes when we're in this. But I also had the sense that somehow it had some meaning, it had some purpose, and it was obviously the biggest thing that ever happened in my life. Maybe I'll stop there for a second and see if you had any response to that. But.
Well, I think for the listeners, this is a very vivid description of how I understand and experience with some of my clients what psychosis is like. And I think that Michael's absolutely right that on the one hand there is trauma, there are crushing events in childhood. They may be subtle crushing events like simply not being loved, which is hard to perceive and see in retrospect.
Yeah.
But there are crushing events. There's often some intervening factor like Michael getting the burns. Often people have been in unstable social situations because I view psychosis, I think one way of viewing it is just a rip in the social fabric. We're all woven together from infancy on. We're made up of this weaving that goes on between us and our caregivers and our siblings and then our schools and so on in the first few years. And that fabric gets ripped up and people lose connectivity and trust and go into this private nightmare. And as Michael's describing it, in my experience with folks, it's usually absolutely terrifying unless there's a grandiose and euphoric, manic-like aspect to it, which can be, sort of empowering temporarily, but it always ends up in catastrophe and terror.
Yeah.
I think this is a vivid description and a good one. One of my questions, Michael, you talked about how it was tied in with the identity issues. I've been thinking a lot about this. I'm working on a new book that comes out in December called Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety. And I spoke at the existential conference not long ago in New York. And I don't know how much of a role as a cause these existential questions about who am I and how do I relate to the universe, how much they're causative. I tend to think that the real trauma is in the emotional destructiveness of the childhood and the early experiences, so that then you end up feeling like you're losing your identity, your personhood. You feel like you're disappearing in shame. I think I also want to talk about. I think it's a very humiliation, a very big part of these experiences, and I want to hear what you say about that. And then I tend to think that leads to the existential kinds of issues. So a couple of thoughts for you about shame, about which comes first, the existential issues or the destructive emotional experiences. So let me pass it back to you on that.
Yes, Peter. I agree with you. Again, for me, having gone through this, it's been like a question. The Zen koan, is that what they call it? You know, the question you ask over and over. So,
yeah.
For me, it's been, if what I went through isn't what psychiatry says it was, then what was it? What is it? And that went on to inform my work for decades. And what I've come to, you know, in recent years, I guess, is more exactly what you're saying, that the emotions that we have are so primary. I've even written some stuff about it on Mad America about the primacy of emotion. We are these mammals with large frontal brain lobes that, you know, we've developed the ability to use language to express ourselves and have symbolic interactions. But if any of us watch our children or grandchildren grow from birth for those first few years, we're really beings that are emotional beings. It's every second a toddler or a baby is expressing, you know, that emotional, that second by second emotional state. And then we become able to learn language and express it that way, and, you know, through imagery and so forth. But I think first and foremost, the so-called symptoms of psychosis, the voices, the delusions, hallucinations, and that quest for meaning, of trying to make sense of what the emotional experience is, then that gives rise to often kind of fantastic stories. But we're trying to find some symbolic way of giving meaning to what we're feeling inside. So it's kind of simple, and maybe it's too simplistic, but I really believe that it all comes from the emotion. Even this second you and I are talking, you know, every second people are breathing, we're in some kind of an emotional state. So in my therapy with people in these states and people not in these states, I'm always trying to tune in to what's the emotions, often plural, that are going on. It's so, even at this late date for me, I don't always know exactly what emotion is going on in me. Sometimes I'll have to find out. Someone will say, "What was going on?" I'll go, "I don't know." You know, I think it's accurate to call them the existential crisis that the Langians describe, and I know your presence at that Lang conference was so welcomed. That's a pretty sophisticated way of naming, I think, that when someone is going through one of these emotional turmoils, there's really a loss of not only consensual reality, but it's a quest for meaning. I think that's part of what I appreciate about my Jungian training with John Weir Perry, who was with Jung in Zurich, and looking at madness as a mystery first and foremost. That certainly answering the question, if it's not what psychiatry says it is, then what is it? I always start with, well, first and foremost, it's a mystery. Then it has a lot to do with emotion, and then, you know, you take the larger, like you say, the fabric of our culture. It's a cultural experience, it's an interpersonal, it's a gender, it's loaded with every level of meaning, but it's a subjective experience. And I've always been thinking that if we can come up with a succinct definition of what that subjective experience is, that would lend itself to a competitive definition. I mean, most psychiatrists you and I know are psychiatric nurses. In 2 minutes, they can tell you or me or a family member or someone suffering this way what's going on with them. You know, it's a biomedical chemical imbalance, like as if you had diabetes, you'll have it for the rest of your life. It's genetic. You know, they have a very shorthand definition of what it is. So I'm kind of rambling here, but back to what you're saying about that question, if it's not what psychiatry says it is, then what is it? I think it's incumbent on this whole movement of wanting to transform the mental health world to have that more readily available. And so these conferences I go to, and then these things I lead at Esalen, I'm going to one in Toronto in June, just about psychosis. And that's what I'm going to bring to it. I'm going to start saying, if it's not what psychiatry says it is, then what is it? Can you put, please write that down on a 3x5 card for me?
What about humiliation? One of my experiences is that when people over, that we can almost look at psychosis as it's usually seen in our, the people who get labeled schizophrenic, the young person like yourself, who's just fallen apart emotionally and goes into this terrifying, nightmarish state. In my experience, the dominant emotion is humiliation, so that it's almost like a giant shame attack, a loss of feeling of being a human being, of being like other human beings, of being connected to other human beings, which we experience as shame and humiliation and a kind of shrinking of ourselves, a terrible experience that just, you know, blushes our whole body, is what, when I get really talking and sharing with folks, that is a huge part of what they're going through. Then there's also the anxiety that comes with feeling that you're disintegrating. But I get the feeling that it's almost like it's an extreme state of shyness, an extreme state of feeling wounded, belittled, put down, and excluded by other human beings. I first talked about that in Toxic Psychiatry, and I'm still evolving and thinking about that, and I wonder what your thoughts are.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that back. You know, that's really important, because my experience and the experience of so many people I've served, and you see it in so many of the accounts now of people bravely telling their stories, is that I'll just talk about my experience first. It was an incredible, crushing sense of shame, and it was shame and loss of I am no longer as I was. I am, and even without the definition of psychiatry, I wasn't taking that on. But my life, the trajectory that I was on, my hopes, I'd been a pre-med student. But who I was, who I'd believed myself to be, there's such a sense of isolation. That was that's the most painful thing, alongside the terror. They kind of build off each other, Peter. It was that sense of being an alien being, being walking among, you know, walking through the streets, going in the stores and stuff, and going, I'm not like you anymore. It almost has that stigma of being an outcast. A modern, you know, I don't know if I should use the term leper though, but it had that. It had that sense of being. Mm-hmm. Less than and feeling like somehow why was this my fate? What did I contribute to this happening? I mean, I usually didn't have that kind of objectivity, but it was a gut level existential sense of being a freak, an outcast, an alien, and. Mm-hmm. That's why I must say, too, one of the things that helped me incredibly out of this was I happened to the college library seeking, this was kind of when I was somewhat out of it, but as soon as I read some writing by Carl Jung, who that's the psychiatrist for people who may not know, who was Freud's heir apparent and went his own way, and Jung went through his own psychotic transformation that we see so graphically now in his red book. As soon as I read some of Jung's stuff, Peter, immediately, like in the first paragraph, I said, oh, he's been through it. I knew it. And it was like a huge weight had been lifted off me that I wasn't the only, when we're in this state, we feel like were the only person going through it. You know what I mean? Because it's so subjective. So shame and that feeling of alienation is enormous. So that's why I think to this day, the thing that drives me the most to try and be there for people is that so they don't have to be alone. Because to be alone in that and feel like you're the only person that this is happening to is what you describe. It's devastating.
Thank you for your frankness, your openness. I think that this hour could be very meaningful to many people. And I want to point out that a lot of people listening to this who have not gone through a madness are still going to understand these feelings of alienation and aloneness. And I want to point out that by and large, you can understand them as experiences of humiliation. And it's often associated with bullying in school or bullying at home or sexual abuse.
Yeah.
To help clarify, I want to contrast it to guilt. Now, guilt is probably more of what my vulnerability has been. My tendency, as I say, before Ginger, BG, which was into my 40s before Ginger, my vulnerability was depression. And in depression, it's not so much that we lose our sense of ourselves, but we feel like we're bad. We're just a bad self. We're not falling apart. We might even feel strong that we can do harm, but we're bad. We're not good. And that usually reflects a different kind of treatment in childhood. Not so much usually in childhood that you've been completely abandoned, so much as you've been and rejected, as you've been told, yeah, you're there, but you're bad. You're not good. You're harmful. You need to get rid of yourself. Your badness and so on. And this very different, deep depression, I think, in that regard is very different than this sense of humiliation that leads to the fall, feeling like you're nobody and nothing and falling apart. I think they're very different experiences, but overlapping, and people have both in combinations, obviously.
Yes.
Well, we've got about two minutes, I think, before the break. At the half hour, we're talking with Michael Cornwall. Michael, in the next couple of minutes, I think we could sort of lead into, we spent the first half talking about what is it like to be psychotic, and in the second we're going to talk about innovative ways that you are very much involved with in helping people help each other get through these kinds of periods. Are you feeling like there's being some progress made in this regard and people realizing that this is a human problem requiring human services?
I really am. I think there's some things going on nationally and internationally now. You mentioned the open dialogue, and we can talk about some of the things that are happening. They're coming into fruition with some alternative services coming online, and I think that's part of what follows from asking the question, if it isn't what psychiatry says it is, what is it? Once you come up with some understanding we're trying to work on here, then the next question that's begged is then how should we respond? Because if it's not what psychiatry says it is, then we're not going to respond like psychiatry does.
Well, good. When we come back, Michael will talk about some of his experiences with helping people come through these things and perhaps what helped him come through. I will talk some about how I work with people in these states because, frankly, it's not the hardest thing in the world to figure out what people need when they're in that degree of alienation from other human beings. It's in some ways a lot simpler than helping more normal kinds of situations in many ways, because you just see so clearly the person's needs for human relationship, some sort of healing human relationship. Well, let's go to break. My engineer, Giselle's right on top of it. Thank you much. We'll go to break and be back with Michael Cornwall. And this is Dr. Peter Breggin. By the way, I don't know if folks can tell a little difference in the quality of my voice in terms of its projection out into the electronic universe. Usually I'm Skyping in to the show on a really good line that I have down in my office. But today we're snowed in upstate New York, and I'm sitting in my office surrounded by glass windows on Cayuga Lake in upstate New York, and speaking to you as I watch ducks and birds sail by and snow flurries adding to the inches on the ground. This is a marvelous show. My guest is Michael Cornwall, and I just want to remind you that he talked at the opening of the show. He's a psychologist, about his own experience of going through madness when he was a 20-year-old man and a boy. And I think that that this first half hour can be exceedingly enlightening to many folks. And remember, you can retrieve it. It's podcast. You can retrieve it off my website, Breggin.com, but also off of PRNFM. Michael, hi. Let's pick up with you talking about what you're doing and thinking about the healing of people in this kind of distress.
Yes, I'd like to update for people some exciting things that are happening nationally that I'm aware of and some things here in the San Francisco Bay Area. Maybe first I could say a little bit about some of the history, a lot of us know we're standing on your shoulders often, Peter, for your work for decades in this area. And I think it's important for people to know that what can change flows out of some really serious work that's been going on for decades, like your friend Bertram Caron, who wrote the classic book on doing therapy, and you know, way back to Frieda Fromm Reichman, even Jung, all that alternative view of what madness or psychosis is. One of the things I'm involved in quite a bit the last, I guess, 4 years now is at Esalen Institute. That's a wonderful place, Big Sur on the west coast here in California, where back in the 60s began part of what is bringing us some gifts today. Richard Price, who was the co-founder of Esalen, went through his own madness processes and ended up in the system, in the hospital, received shock treatment and insulin treatment. And so when he recovered enough to come here to the West Coast, he teamed up with Michael Murphy, and they formed Esalen Institute, as some of your listeners know, is really the impetus for the human potential movement, the work of Abraham Maslow, and a lot of great humanistic psychology has come out of there. But Richard Price, from the beginning, started convening these gatherings at Esalen, starting to do what we're talking about right here today, revisioning madness. What is it if it's not what psychiatry says it is? And then how should we humanely respond? So my mentor, John Weir Perry, was down there for some of those gatherings where Gregory Bateson and Fritz Perls and R.D. Lang and Price and Murphy and others were there. And one summer, Peter, in 1968, they had a whole summer symposium there on this. So about 4 years ago, I started doing some workshop. I did a workshop there at Esalen, and then the last couple years have convened these week-long gatherings with 30, now 40 people came. Leaders in this alternative movement, and then I think I'm going to do one again in December. So the whole impetus for creating new programs, I think then and now, needs to be based on coming up with justification for it. If I could just say quickly, one of the main things that even today Robert Whitaker, every time he's out there talking about the research, talks about this research at the Agnew State Hospital. It's under Rappaport, if people want to look it up, that Esalen and Richard Price made happen, where they had a large grant from the National Institute of Mental Health. It was a gold standard randomized double blind study where 40 young men who were in an early psychotic state were given placebo, and the other 40 were given Thorazine. No one knew who was getting the meds or not. And the results from that were really revolutionary. They showed that the young men who didn't get the medication at three-year follow-up had about a 70% lower rehospitalization rate. So the notion that the quick symptom reduction that, yes, these emotion-numbing drugs will do, doesn't serve people in the long run. The people who got the meds had pretty quick symptom reduction, but the people who were allowed to go through this transformative process, a large number of them weren't in the system. From that, the place I worked at then in Contra Costa County was open for 8 years, 20 beds, no diagnosis, no restraints, no medication. I ward, it was called, and that was only made possible because of this Esalen Agnew's project research, and John Muir Perry's place in Diabasis was funded because of it. Lauren Mosier had the one you know of, Soteria in San Jose. So there's a history, a solid history of these programs that basically can divert the majority of people from the mental health system. It's always seemed almost surreal to me that these programs haven't existed for the last 30 years. You know, we have 40,000 acute services beds for people in acute crisis psychiatric beds in the United States. And right now, I think there's only five up in Soteria, Alaska that provide this. So maybe I'll just stop there. We can talk about the history and the tradition that you're part of a little bit. And there's some exciting things going on in the Bay Area I can describe later.
Well, I just want to briefly give folks a little bit of history about it and then ask you a basic question about, just to sort of give you a little advance, basic question about what goes into helping people. You've mentioned some of the programs. The drugs don't help. I think being diagnosed doesn't help. But I want you thinking about what's the essence of what's going to be helpful to folks who are going through this kind of potentially overwhelming, overwhelming experience. It's interesting what you said, that actually there's been a decline in the last 30 years of helpful approaches to deeply distressed and disturbed people. As many of you know, I got started doing volunteer work in a state mental hospital when I was an 18-year-old, working with the most desperately people in the most desperate condition and the most abused in the state hospitals. And we ended up in our case aid part of the program and getting these folks out of the hospital back into the community. So early on, it was obvious to me that people and not pills that mattered, that it was human caring that mattered. And I even wrote about that as a college student. Now, what's happened since then, see, at that point, we got a lot of support from organized psychiatry. They were happy to be doing their lobotomies, and they literally were doing them then a lot, and doing their drugs and all, but they also had this sort of a psychosocial and psychoanalytic bent within psychiatry that encouraged me as a young man to be a leader literally in psychiatry as a kid, doing these programs and talking about them and writing about them. That's gone now. There isn't any of that. And now the whole theme is you can't even talk to this so-called schizophrenia. That's all a product of the partnership between the drug companies and psychiatry and medicine, which I describe that evolution. I document the evolution in toxic psychiatry. So I think that's the basic history, that there isn't progress necessary in psychiatry, because psychiatry is so heavily influenced by and is almost essentially political in nature. And now we're trying to revive things that were actually more available in the intellectual life of America back in the 60s and early 70s than today, about looking at madness as a human phenomena. And we're really trying to bring it back. Is that a fair assessment?
It's totally fair, and again, your role, and I remember reading Toxic Psychiatry back kind of in the dark days of the Reagan administration when everything was being taken away. And it was like, oh, thank God there's still a psychiatrist out there who gets it, you know. And then I became aware of your work going way back. I mean, that's it. I mean, before break, you said something about it's so simple, but when I do these workshops and trainings, even for therapists who and psychiatrists sometimes, I can see the light go on. I say, you know, I often refer to your work, it's that human connection, that heart-centered, I even use the word loving, compassionate, whatever. You know, when we're suffering, that's what we want. And Lauren Mosier and I did a workshop on this before he passed. And basically we're saying, whether it's Soteria House or Lang's Kingsley Hall or I Ward where I was or Diabasis or any of these places, the necessary and sufficient condition for people to go through this process, it's a transformative process, it's a healing process for most people. And even the ones who don't get it during that initial phase, I found and work with, also totally respond to that compassionate, empathic connection. So what if that's true? And I believe it's absolutely true, that the necessary and sufficient conditions for people, and not just when they're psychotic either, you know, any of us, when we are suffering or afraid or disoriented, if it's that loving presence of another person receiving us without judgment, without pathologizing us, what if that is the good medicine? And it is. All these programs have demonstrated that, and there's research now that draws on some of that earlier work. But John Bola, some people have read his research that, you know, was on the front page of the New York Times just a few years ago. There was an outcry, but it was this world-class, it was in schizophrenia bulletin, Peter, I don't know if you remember that. It was like the research demonstrates this too, what you're talking about.
Give us that last name again, John
Bola, B-O-L-A. And he's a world-class researcher who was written up in the Schizophrenia Bulletin basically saying that these psychosocial interventions for psychosis should absolutely be offered. People should have the opportunity to have that instead of just the medication and, like you say, the lifelong sentence that's passed when the diagnosis is given, that you're going to be on these meds the rest of your life. I mean, so much is happening. That peril research that Bob Whitaker talks about, the 15 and 20 year longitudinal studies that show that people who went off the medication do better than the people who were on the medication. There's so much evidence now coming in from Open Dialogue in Finland, like you said, showing that they're dramatically reducing the number of people in the system. So, I mean, when I do these talks around, I say, you know, what if this is true, then 50% of the people who are currently trapped in our mental health system wouldn't be there. I mean, it's almost like, again, it's kind of surreal to me that people go, 50%? I go, yeah. see what I mean? It has that quality of what people need is simple and humane, and the effects of that could be so dramatic.
Yeah, one of the things that the audience out there, wonderful folks, might be interested in knowing is that therapists like Michael and myself are in a very different position than the new and young psychologists and psychiatrists who are being trained, because nowadays, the moment you show any sort of aberration from normal, let alone a hallucination or a delusion, you're drugged. You're drugged by your primary care doc on the way to the hospital. You're drugged by your ER doc on the way into the hospital. So that psychologists and psychiatrists who have been trained in the last decades have actually never worked with an unmedicated, very upset human being. They have no experience. So when Michael and I talk about what it's like to be going through madness, what it's like to help somebody going through madness, the young psychiatrists and psychologists, by that I mean, you know, last 20, 30 years, actually probably pretty much since the advent of the antipsychotic drugs, but especially, I'd say, since the 70s, they have no idea about talking to somebody who's been disturbed and is really, really in despair, but is unmedicated so that they can talk with you and be with you and share with you. The only unmedicated patients that the modern mental health care provider ever sees are the people who are off their drugs, in withdrawal, and going bonkers from that, often much worse than before they were put on drugs. And the health professionals nowadays completely get confused by that and think that people need their drugs when they're just seeing people in withdrawal. So, I mean, that might be interesting for you to address how you and I at our age now are in this unusual position that we've worked for decades with people who are seriously emotionally disturbed, and the average psychiatrist never done it without drugs.
That's a great point, and I must say that in these trainings I've done with interns, counselors, therapists, not so much psychiatrists, but as soon as they hear that actually there's another approach than what they were taught in grad school, they go, well, I wish I'd learned that. I wish they'd taught us that in grad school, because so many of them get it, that there's something about that human-hearted approach. But I think what you're saying, too, Peter, also accounts for the generations of especially psychiatrists. And I worked in a public system for almost 30 years, and they were some of the best people I've ever known. But they believe that medical model dogma. And so then it almost dictates that they have to put now a little girl or boy, I've seen them and it breaks my heart, who's 4 years old, who's been diagnosed bipolar because they are up at night crying. This child must be bipolar. They won't stop crying. They're upset. So let's put them on antipsychotic meds. I mean, you can't make that leap. Again, the theory and the belief system dictates the treatment. If you believe that the child has a broken brain and you should give them antipsychotic medications when they're 4 years old, then that's what you do. So, I mean, I don't think we're voices crying in the wilderness completely, because there's a lot of people who, as soon as they hear, you know, what you're saying, they start to go, wow, that sounds better. And not only that, it kind of resonates with people. But it's terrifying to me to see now that in, you know, over 40 states in the United States, forced treatment is the law of the land. Here in California, we're fighting that in the Bay Area. And with NAMI, with psychiatry, with Big Pharma, they've basically taken over every dollar. You know, to have any kind of mental health treatment now, it has to have a DSM diagnosis. If it has a diagnosis, that diagnosis almost always means meds. And now in over 44 states, people, you know, adults can be court-ordered in their homes to have this stuff. So it's almost like the worst of days, Peter, and the best of days, because I see so many hopeful things happening, too.
Yeah. I want to say that drugging people involuntarily and then continuing it when they're outside the hospital so they get these long-acting injections of drugs, and then if they don't show up in 2 weeks or 3 weeks or whatever the time period is at the clinic, they can automatically send folks out to give them a shot in the home or drag them in and give them a shot. This is slavery. This is slavery to the pharmaceutical industry. And I've never put it quite like that, but think of it. You got this pharmaceutical industry making billions of dollars off of these extremely expensive and worthless, damaging antipsychotic drugs. And you've got all their minions in forms of the mental health professionals, and they're making their living in part by enslaving involuntary people in their homes and in the community. It's outrageous. And, you know, I've never let myself just express it like that before, Michael. It's just outrageous.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more. It's a form of slavery is the right word. If people have no option to live in the community without being shackled and injected with this decanoid antipsychotic that stays in their system for a month. I mean, the civil liberties, I mean, this is a human rights campaign, Peter, that you and I have been waging, and now people are doing it more and more. I mean, the UN now, under the auspices of their, whatever, the people who talk about torture there, they've identified that forced psychiatric treatment is a form of torture, and Tina Minkowitz and some of the people are doing on that.
Torture,
I mean,
and slavery.
In New York, it was in the New York Times or Washington Post, I think, the police will show up if the person doesn't get their shot after a month.
Yeah.
I mean, that's, you just can't, I'm with you. Let's name it for what it is. Let's don't paper it over. It's a human rights abuse. It's a police state kind of thing where basically, I got to say, society is totally responsible for this too, because we've sanctioned psychiatry to be the deviance police in our culture.
Well, and I really want to emphasize that this slavery is literally a slavery for profit, like all slavery is.
Good
and it's
point.
For the profit of organizations like NAMI, the National Alliance of Mentally Ill, is getting money from the drug companies. It's the profit of the doctors and the hospitals and the clinics, and in the largest way, the profit of the pharmaceutical industry. And the slavery is twofold. It's the slavery of being forced into this chattel state in relationship to the powers of the society, but it's also a slavery worse than other kinds of slavery, because once you're injected, your frontal lobes are so inhibited and so injured that you don't even have the will and the strength to do something like escape the country or escape north,
right.
Get on the Underground Railroad, which there is at times a bit of an Underground Railroad for this. But the folks on the drugs don't have the wherewithal to do that because of these drugs, which crush the human will.
Absolutely. And as far as I know, the research is showing now that every year that someone is on some of these high-powered antipsychotics, people who are out there on their meds, you and I always say, we're not telling you or advising you to go off your meds or anything, but I think we have to boldly say that, I guess, from what I know, the research says that every year someone is on these antipsychotic meds, they may be having a 1% shrinkage of their brain tissue. I mean, you put that 10 years, what if you lose 10% of your brain? Again, the ability to function, the ability to be autonomous then.
Yes.
And the tardive psychosis that you've documented, the drugs themselves cause psychosis after a certain point.
Yeah, I'm very glad for this show, because it's really time to just get very specific and explicit about this. The antipsychotic drugs, Bob Whitaker has documented this. I documented in my most recent book, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal. First half, I talk about these kinds of issues, the second half about withdrawal. They're shortening lifespan, maybe up to 20 years. We're not seeing old people on these drugs for 20 years. They're causing obesity and diabetes and all kinds of life-shortening and quality-of-life-ruining effects. And we're talking now about drugs like Abilify and Seroquel and Invega and Risperdal and Zyprexa. These are devastating drugs, and again, you can't just stop them. You need to find some kind of help, some kind of wraparound help in a family or a group, and hopefully some kind of clinical supervision, because coming off these drugs can be so dangerous. We're finishing on a very strong note here. Michael Cornwall, It is amazing to have you on the radio with me. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Peter, so much.